Hello and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. And today we've got a great show lined up for you. We're going to jump into that in just a few moments. I want to remind people we have an event coming up, the Holzer Files Hell Frozen Over event. It'll be Shane Pittman and myself from the Holzer Files, along with Bill Chappell and medium Jamie Houck, will be at the Palmer House Hotel in Sauk Center, Minnesota. We are completely sold out now of all of the full event tickets, but we do have general admission tickets left for the meet and greet party, all of the talks, the presentations. So if you're still interested in that, $99, you can go sign up for it and come hang out for the weekend and get a chance to meet with Shane and I and Bill Chappell, Jamie Houck. It's going to be a lot of fun. All the information is at darknessevents.com. That's darknessevents.com. And for those of you that have been having trouble with the show the last week here, there has been an issue on Stitcher's main internet website. So if you usually access it through the internet and are having trouble getting it there, make sure that you've got the Stitcher app. It's a free app, and you can actually access the show that way. The app is working just fine. I just wanted to alert everybody to what's going on and make them aware that we are aware of the issues taking place currently with the internet version of Stitcher. So they are diligently working on trying to modify and figure out that issue. So as soon as they get that fixed, it'll be running again as normal. All right. Today, we've got an interesting guest joining us. Dr. Irina McAmon Scott is here. Beyond Pascagoula, the rest of the amazing story. And this is a fascinating tale, probably best known for the events that unfolded on October 1973 with the Pascagoula abduction account of Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker. It is one of the more credible reports, but unlike many reports, intensive research has actually uncovered a number of additional reports of UFO sightings in the area at around the same time. Dr. Scott, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Let's dig in. For people that are not familiar with this case, if we could at least do a recap for them, what took place in Pascagoula in October of 1973?
What took place on the 11th of October, 1973, was a reported UFO abduction and of Calvin Parker and Charles Hickson. It's called the Pascagoula abduction, and it's one of the best known abductions, and it's probably the best documented of any of them because we've been working quite a while getting other witnesses and things. What happened was the original abduction was that Calvin Parker was 18 or 19 and Charles Hickson was around 45. They were shipyard employees after their day of work, and they decided to go fishing. And they weren't UFO nuts or anything else like that. They were just regular, normal people that would probably laugh if you said UFOs. They went to a couple of places fishing, and they weren't catching anything. And so they went to this other place that was kind of marked stay out or something. And Calvin was a little bit nervous about parking there because it was his car, and he's afraid they might get in trouble. But Charles said, everything's fine, let's go. He parks there all the time. And so they went out they parked and walked to the pier and went out on the pier and started fishing. The first thing they saw was a blue light. And Calvin was pretty nervous. He thought it was, they both thought it was the police. And he told Charles that he can go to jail because it was his idea and stuff. But it was a lot worse than police, because it was this object that appeared. And it was floating off the ground. At first it was blue, and then it opened with this real bright light. And two things that might have been beings or creatures or something grabbed Charles, and one grabbed Calvin and took him inside the object and did what appeared to be scans on him, and then took him outside. Well, they were both absolutely terrified beyond anything you can imagine. And they couldn't fight back. They couldn't move when it was happening. And so anyway, they delivered them back to the pier. And Calvin was just standing there with his hands, with his arms up in the air. And Charles tried to break the trance. And I think they both fell down or something. Then the thing disappeared. And at first they both said, well, we're not going to report that. And that would be obvious because everybody would make fun of them if you just called somebody and said, well, we were abducted by a UFO. You can imagine how that would feel. So they then Charles was an older man, and he'd been in the army and been in life and death situations fighting in the war, in wars. And so he was more acclimated to having something like that happen to him. And he said, we should report it. Well, Calvin was never in favor of reporting it. So they, first of all, tried the newspaper, and the newspaper was closed. Then they tried Kessler Air Force Base to report to the Air Force. And the Air Force said that they'd closed Project Blue Book and they no longer took UFO reports. And they told them to report to somebody local. So they then called the police. And you can imagine what the police would think if somebody just called and said that. And I talked to some, I interviewed, you know, some other policemen that weren't there and just heard the report. And they said the report was that the police picked up two drunks that were saying they reported they had been aboard a UFO and that sort of thing. So it wasn't taken seriously, except that the person that talked to Hickson could hear Calvin in the background crying and pleading not to report it and everything else. So they took it a little bit seriously. They brought him into the police station and interviewed him separately and then put him together in a room and somebody talked to him. And the person left and left him alone. But what had happened is that the police had a tape recorder hidden in the room. And they thought that with this tape recorder that they would find him in the hoax. And they thought as soon as the police left that they would be laughing and everything else on the way they had hoaxed him. But instead, the two men were just absolutely terrified. And they were talking in kind of a clipped way you would if you were terrified. Everybody could tell they were terrified, and that made people think they were take it a lot more seriously. And so this was called the mystery tape, and it's on the internet. I don't know the address, but after that, they were taken seriously by a number of people, and they had reported immediately, and there were two of them, unlike lots of reports where there's just one person, and they wait 20 years to say anything. So then the UFO investigators came out immediately and started investigating. So that's one of the reasons it was, and then it just blew up. It was in all the newspapers all over the world immediately because it was a pretty good report.
How were people reacting at that time? Hearing this report, was it tongue in cheek and kind of mocking these two guys? Were the media sources taking them seriously? How would you describe what was happening for both of them?
I think it was better than normal on account of the mystery tape and the police. The newspapers didn't really report it as being crazy, but I think the two men were severely harassed. And I've talked to a number of people from Pascagoula that, you know, they harassed them, said they were drunk and everything, seeing things and all that. So I think the men were very harassed. And you can imagine shipyard workers, what
right.
Like that.
Right. But they were standing by their story. And here you've got a former military guy. You've got somebody with some credibility on this. As we look back on these two gentlemen, had there been issues, you know, could we look at this and say, and I, again, I'm just taking the skeptical approach at the beginning here to kind of answer some questions I know the audience will have, but is there any chance that these guys were scoundrels and had done dumb things in the past? And, you know, maybe they should have been looked at a little bit more skeptically at the time.
Well, I think a lot of people were very skeptical and harassing him. But on the other hand, some of the top UFO investigators were out there immediately, and other people talked to him. And like, I talked to the doctor that interviewed him right after it happened, and he said, yeah, they were both in shock, and there wasn't any doubt about that. So I think the people that came in contact with him, and especially the mystery tape, did believe him, although it was unbelievable.
They see these strange things during this experience. Can you describe to us, and I know that there have been drawings and a considerable amount put out there regarding this, what type of things did they see? What did they experience?
Well, they weren't the typical aliens that are in the press. They were quite a bit different. They were kind of the typical alien is kind of a skinny thing with a big head and legs and big eyes. Well, these things were a lot different. They were kind of heavy set or porky even. They were very, very wrinkled. They couldn't even see their eyes. I think they were gray. The skin was kind of gray. And in a lot of drawings, Hickson reported that where you have projections on your head, like the nose and the ears, there were things like carrots sticking out. And they both thought the things might have been mechanical instead of beings, that they just gave them the impression of behaving in mechanical ways.
Now, the beings, did they ever interact with them? Did they, you know, speak? Did they give any kind of indication that there was an intelligence there? Aside from being able to traverse the galaxy in a UFO, I mean, like a communicative way.
Well, anybody in that position would try to fight back. And they said that they thought they'd been injected with something or had a shot, because when the things grabbed them, they couldn't fight back. And they thought maybe they had received a shot, but they were like, they were paralyzed and couldn't move except they could see and they were conscious. For their memory of right then, which was a conscious memory, I think they communicated by telepathy and told them not to worry and things like that, which you would obviously worry.
Right. Yeah. That's not enough to make me more comfortable with the situation. Yeah. How long do they think that they were actually abducted?
I had the impression it was about 15 to 30 minutes. They didn't have watches on them, so they weren't.
Right. And they have this encounter, they're returned. Do they show any long-term effect from being around these beings?
Well, Calvin was really nervous about it, and he was afraid they might be contaminated or something. And they had some effects. There were pictures taken of marks on them that might have been puncture marks. They thought they were maybe injected. But we've had people look at the pictures that we had and that came from somebody else. And the ones that on Charles looked like just surface scratches or just scratches. And the ones on Calvin looked like they could have been puncture marks, except it was on his feet. But, you know, it might have been, they might have taken his shoes off too. And so there wasn't real proof. On one of the documents, sometime later, they said that their eyes were dilated. And that wouldn't be from being on board the craft, because it was lit up really bright, and bright lights would make your eyes constrict. If your eyes were dilated, that might be a sign that you were given drugs. And they thought they were given drugs.
Right. Were they tested for that to see, you know, through toxicology, if there truly was something foreign in their system?
No. And that's a shame, because I don't think there's any blood samples or anything. Calvin was really, really nervous that he might have been contaminated. And he took his clothes off, and I think he washed in bleach or something afterwards and threw his clothes away. And he was trying to get them to test for radioactivity and things, and they took him to, first of all, hospital, and then to a better hospital at the Air Force Base, Kessler Air Force Base, and didn't find any radioactivity. But he was very concerned that he might be contaminated in some way and, you know, come in contact with other people.
Right. Now, what could you tell us regarding the craft itself? Is this something that fits other versions? Because obviously the aliens sound completely different than what, you know, we're used to hearing. What was the craft itself like?
I think it was, one of them described it as being about 30 feet long and maybe 18 feet tall. And I think that was a guess. On the inside, they really didn't see anything. It was just really brightly lit. They didn't see furniture or anything. They said that they went through something like that. They'd been examined, and that something came out from the wall and circled them. And that's sort of like a CAT scan now, except for CAT scan now, they put you on a gurney and shove you in a, you know, a big machine. Well, this seemed like it would, you know, if it had been a real scan, that it was a lot more advanced than what we even have today. Kelvin described the table he'd been put on as glass, and I think that was because he didn't see anything. And I don't think they saw any furniture. I think they just saw bright lights in these beings, or whatever they were.
Did the craft itself, did it make any sound? What all could they tell of it? And did it just kind of appear? And do they remember, after being replaced, did it disappear in front of them?
There was a sound that one of them described like a zipping sound, and it flew away. And I don't know if there was some kind of a sound, I think, when it appeared, too. It wasn't like an airplane or anything, though. I think they described it as like a zipping sound.
What is the area like? I mean, in that part of the world, are people, were they open to this? Did people start a panic and fear that there was something strange and otherworldly around them? Or was it just kind of, oh, that's interesting, that's fascinating, and, you know, or those guys are nuts and they just rolled on about their normal days?
I think that probably most people rolled on, but there were a huge amount of sightings then. And from the police, we had like 50 sightings reported for that night of the abduction from other people. And then there were other ones that they knew about that weren't reported. So a lot of people had seen things. And in that case, you might not remember anything from, you know, the October 11th, 1973. But the abduction account hit the newspapers the next day. And if you had seen something and then you read that account, you would be able to know when it was. And if it was very impressive, you'd remember that for a long time. Well, people didn't come out of the woodwork report things at first, because the two abductees were getting harassed and made fun of. But since then, the idea of UFOs is now more respectable, and people are coming out and saying, yeah, they saw things then too, and they didn't want to talk about it and get harassed then, but they can stand up to it now. So we're collecting reports from way back.
Speaking of reports, I saw through the Mississippi Press Register There was an article that scientists term that the Pascagoula UFO report is true. Was that true? Were these true scientists that had come forward to make this claim? And what made them believe that there was something more to this than just two good old boys that might have had a few too many drinks that night?
Two really top scientists came out to investigate. One was Dr. Alan Hynek. He had been the Blue Book debunker for a long time, but he changed his mind on debunking and was open to UFOs. He was a respectable scientist. He was an astronomer with a PhD. I knew him from back here. He was he worked for the astronomy department of OSU, and then he went to Northwestern University and became the head of the astronomy department. And he did research and published good scientific papers on astronomy. So he was respectable in his field. Another one was Dr. Harder from Berkeley, the University of California or Southern California, I forget which. And he was a respectable scientist too. And they both got out there real soon after it happened and interviewed him. And both of them trusted the two men. They didn't think they were nuts or anything. They took him as honest and reporting what they saw.
And with that, in that area, you know, I'm sure people are wondering, this was kind of a restricted area that they were in. Do we know why it was restricted? Was it part of government property? Was there anything like that that might lend itself to us understanding a little bit better?
It was the area of Huntington Ingalls industry, and this was the Navy's largest shipbuilding industry. It was in there in another place, but this was a important company, very important for shipbuilding. Also, there was a nuclear site there. I don't know exactly what they were doing, probably something with shipbuilding, but the government was trying to hide that from people, and they didn't want people to know about it. And also Kessler Air Force Base, which was a real big training ground and high-tech area. So it wasn't just like, you know, some place by the Gulf. It was had a lot of military places.
Well, all right. So could it be that they misunderstood that this was more a uniform to protect somebody from nuclear waste, nuclear fallout, something like that? And could it be that whoever was inside these uniforms might have taken them to test them to make sure that they were not infected by this, by crossing the boundaries and into that area?
It's unknown. It could be. There could be a million theories, and it's really unknown. They thought when it was happening that maybe it was the government, but there wasn't any evidence that it was the government, and this was way beyond what the government can do.
Well, at least what we thought they could do, right? Now we're learning more and more what the government's been capable of for a long time. And I'm not meaning to sound skeptical as though to challenge all of your insights and claims on this. Again, just trying to be the voice of the audience as they're listening along with us on this journey. And, you know, because this is such a unique, at least to many of us, abduction scenario, the look, the feel, everything about it is kind of different than, you know, the big gray aliens, the mantis, the Nordics, the things that people have come to somehow accept those aspects of alien forms. But this is something new, something different.
I think if they were lying, that they would look up what an alien looked like and describe it like other people did. And theirs was completely different. And that suggests maybe they're truthful. But everybody that talked to them thought they were truthful just by their own feelings.
All right. Now that they've had this experience, did either one of them ever feel as though they were visited again by these beings, or was it a one and done situation for them?
Well, I think with that, you should distinguish between what their actual conscious memory was, because they were hypnotized. And after the hypnosis, Calvin remembered a possible earlier abduction and a later one. But that was under hypnosis. Some people question hypnosis. I'm not saying whether hypnosis is right or wrong. I just thought I should say that what they remembered consciously and what was under hypnosis.
Now, they said, Hixon and Parker, that these robot creatures were friendly. Is it just because they took them and replaced them? They abducted them. They were both kind of unnerved by them, especially Calvin Parker, and, you know, a little bit more frightened by what took place. Why did they have the sense that the creatures were friendly?
I guess because they survived.
Okay.
Like, that would scare you to death, and maybe they were so happy they were alive that they thought, oh, these are friendly.
Now, it said, just kind of glancing at this article from back in the day, October 19th, 1973, it says, according to Hixon and Parker, we were fishing last Thursday night behind old, Shopster Shipyard building on the Pascagoula River. I turned to get some more bait when I heard a zipping sound. I turned around and saw a spacecraft with bright, flashing, blue-looking lights, just hovering without touching the ground. It seemed to open up, but there really wasn't a door there at all. These three creatures came floating out towards us. I was scared that I couldn't believe it was actually happening. The creatures were pale, ghost-like, about 5 feet high. They were sort of light flesh-colored, or more like a pale gray, with crab-like claws for hands and rounded feet. The creatures were on us before we knew it. Two of them seemed to lift me off the ground, and I became motionless and glided into the craft. Parker said he passed out as he was carried into the craft. After I got inside, I had no feelings. I was helpless, but I could still move my eyes. It was real bright inside, but no particular color. There were no light fixtures, but it was plenty bright. Something big and round that looked like a big eye moved back and forth across my body. The two creatures moved me around so that the eye could check me in various positions. I just kind of floated without touching anything. I didn't see any attachment for the eye. It was just kind of suspended in the air. The two things left me for a while, maybe a half a minute, and I was in there just motionless. All I could do was move my eyes. I never felt any pain. They didn't hurt us at all. Later, they carried me back outside, and I floated down on my feet. I was so weak-kneed, I think I fell over. The creatures didn't walk at all. Their legs stayed together, and they kind of floated. After I have thought more about it, I believe that they were more like robots. They acted like they had a specific job to do, and they did it. They didn't try to communicate with us. I heard one of them making a buzzing sound. It might have been in contact with something somewhere else. I didn't see the opening in the front of the face move. I didn't see anything that looked like eyes. There was something pointing out like a nose and then an opening under its eyes, or under this, but no eyes. The craft, which was rounded or oval, was about 8 to 10 feet wide and about 8 feet high. Came up as a split second and it left with a zip. It was gone in a half second. They were on us so quick, we couldn't do anything. I doubt if we could have resisted them if we had tried to. I'm sure they are far more advanced than we are. I know now that they didn't intend to hurt us physically, but I feared that they were going to take us away. I would like to emphasize that they didn't mean us any harm. I honestly believe other people will go through similar experiences. I think these creatures will continue to probe this earth. We haven't seen the last of it. I've always said that there's almost had to be some life elsewhere. Now I'm a firm believer. Our lives will never be the same, but I felt we owed it to the people to tell what we saw. I don't believe I could live with it myself. I believe we have done what is right. The question I keep asking myself is, why a country boy like me? And that's a fascinating take on all of this, and that he was assured or was positive of the fact that this was going to continue, more people would be taken. It's almost like he was given a knowing. Would you say that's a fair assessment? Since they didn't really communicate with him, he seemed very clear-headed and understanding that this was not out of the ordinary and would continue.
That was his feelings about it. And I guess that maybe he had some feeling of communication was why he had those feelings. I mean, if it happened to me, I would be so glad I was alive. But, you know, and I would also wonder if other people were thinking and not return. But, you know, that was his feelings, I guess.
Well, what can you tell us about the fact that, okay, aside from two men who claim to have had this experience, was there any other type of physical or relatable data? And I mean that because there's another article again that says, men taken aboard UFO, nearby radar jammed. That's the headlines from October 15th, 1973. What do we know about these claims of radar being jammed? Are we assuming that because radar didn't pick them up? Or was there a legitimate hiccup and issue with radar locally in that area that night?
Well, I don't think that the radar was the same night. This radar man reported having his radar jammed for some time. And he'd been in the military and, you know, knew what radar jamming was. And he had picked up something and then it jammed his radar for a while.
We've got in the article, it says a Marion County civil defense official reported an unidentified flying object knocked out his radar Sunday night shortly after two scientists said that they were still convinced two men were taken aboard a UFO along the Gulf Coast near Pascagoula. Dr. James Harder of the University of California and Alan Hynek, chairman of the astronomy department at Northwestern University, said they were convinced Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker encountered a non-terrestrial craft. A short time later, James Thornhill of Columbia said he picked up an object on his radar set. I observed what I thought to be an aircraft, Thornhill told officials. It got rather close to the station, about 3 miles, then it became stationary. And all of a sudden, my radar just completely jammed. I've never seen anything quite like this, except perhaps during World War II. Thornhill said the radar unit developed streaks when the UFO returned later. Area residents, he said, reported seeing a craft with bright blue lights Sunday night. Thornhill's report was the latest in the series of UFO sightings that reached its most bizarre period Thursday night. Hickson and Parker went to authorities saying that they were taken aboard a UFO. These are not imbalanced people, J. Allen Hynek said. They're not crackpots. There was definitely something here that was not terrestrial of this earth. Hickson and Parker said that they were fishing when a bluish craft hovered above them and they were taken inside by, now it said here, red-skinned occupants without force. And this is interesting because that totally flies in the face of the gray or very pale skin story before. The pair said the craft's occupants had wrinkled skin, pointed ears, eye slits, sharp noses, and holes below their noses. Now, again, an article written within a few days of the first one is saying that there were eye slits when the other article said there were not. So there does seem to be some inconsistencies in how the story was told. Is that reporter error? And I'm going to say this wholeheartedly. I've been interviewed numerous times in the last 15 years and will go back and read the article and think I never said that. And I certainly didn't report that. And I've called them out on it. And they, well, we just tried to punch up the article. It seems normal in some cases, which is really kind of disconcerting to me. But what do you think was taking place here?
Well, with the radar jamming, the abduction was on Thursday and the radar, I think, was on Sunday. So it wasn't the same day and it wasn't exactly the same place, but it was still an experienced person in that area thought, said the radar was jammed.
Right. But I'm talking about the inconsistencies and the colorization, there were no eyes, there were eye slits. They were pale gray, almost like an elephant. This is saying that they were reddish. Does that start to send up any flags for you when the accounts that were given at the time are being, I don't want to say misrepresented, but that they're certainly not consistent.
Well, I think, with newspapers, you can get different things when reporters write things up that they can change things. I think that I talked to the doctor that examined him first. And he said the very first reports were good. And to pay attention to those first ones, but I think, you know, as more people read it and report it and so on, that there will be differences. I think the two people reported pretty much the same thing for that night, always. I don't think they changed their, you know, what they said.
All right, let's do this. We need to take a break. The book is called Beyond Pascagoula, The Rest of the Amazing Story. We have a link up for that book on today's program guide, so you can find it very easy. Get a copy for yourself. We'll be back. We've got more to talk with Dr. Irina Scott right here on Darkness Radio. All right. I'm curious what your thoughts are as we look at this story, Dr. Scott. And obviously, we've seen a lot, you know, with this case. We've seen that, you know, not only two men had this experience, but an experienced civil defense official reported seeing an unidentified flying object two nights later that knocked out his radar. You know, two prominent scientists came to the site and actually checked it out and found it to be very credible. But there was a lot more to the story and many more people that came forward. How do we differentiate, though, their stories of being real or fictional? Because we know in the Roswell story, many people came out after the fact, but their stories were discounted because wrong time, wrong place, wrong information. They weren't even in the city or state at that time, so it was easy to kind of de-evolve those stories. But almost 50 years later, how do you separate the fact from fiction from the people that do decide to come forward?
I interviewed a lot of the people and tape recorded the interviews with their permission, and tried in any way I could. Whenever I interviewed anybody, I asked if they had told other people at the time and who they had told, so that I have some record of that. But in a lot of cases, people are dead and you can't find the other witnesses. But I attempted to do all I could to find out what they had said at the time and whether they had told anybody at the time. And that's about as much as I could do. But so I do have the information, and it's something to keep on investigating.
Is it one of those where you're just going to report the stories and allow people to make the decision on their own kind of feel? Is that the concept of following up with a book like this and having all these new stories and new insights to these cases?
Yeah. Many people would allow us to use their actual name, which means other people can contact them. And we're not saying that everybody's absolutely saying the truth. They're just doing the best they can, and so are we. We didn't censor too much information, and we tried to check out what we could. But there's a lot we couldn't check out, but maybe somebody else can. So we tried to give as much information as we could.
Well, let's look at some of these other cases, these other aspects of the story. What stood out to you the most from people that decided to come forward?
Well, the people that came, that I heard about first, were the Blair family. And Philip found out about that. Calvin had given a presentation at the Pascagoula Library. They had put that on YouTube, and somebody wrote in and made the comment and said, well, she knows it's true because her parents were there and saw what happened. So Philip contacted the woman and gave me the phone number and everything of her parents. So I contacted them. And I first of all talked to her father, who talked very briefly and said, hear a big splash and something about thinking it was a blimp. And then he turned the phone over to his wife. His wife said that he was a skeptic and that he didn't believe. And you know, he was down on everything, didn't want to talk about it and all that. She said that she and her husband were there that night, and they were, he was to go with his supervisor on a trip on a boat, and I don't know what kind of work they were doing, but the supervisor was late, and so they were parked there, and he was asleep in the car, parked by the pier. They were on the other side of the river from where Calvin and Charles were. She said she saw this, what she thought was an airplane, flying around the Pascagoula River, up and down and across and randomly, and she said she thought the pilot didn't know what he was doing or where he was going, and he was just flying around, and she didn't see any pattern of what he was doing. Then she said about 9 o'clock, her husband decided to put his clothes in the boat. And so they were going to walk down the pier and put his clothes in the boat. And they were walking. He was ahead of her a little. And she said this thing came out of the water that looked like a person and then went back in and never came up again for air. And then they walked on out to the and she said something to her husband about it. And then they walked on out to the boat and she came back at around 12 and was so scared she ran down the pier and jumped in the car. She seemed very emotional about this thing that came out of the water. And so I called her and talked to her a couple of times. And I asked her if it was a fish, and she said, no, it was nothing like a fish, and a dolphin, no. And she said it looked like a man. And so I talked to her a number of times about that, and she was very emotional about this thing that came out of the water, and saying her husband was a skeptic. Later, her husband became very ill and died. And before he went on a ventilator, he told her that they had been abducted, that these things had come out of the... He was a skeptic all this time and hadn't talked about it. He said they had been abducted. He said that to her, and he also told it to Philip Mantle by telephone, that they'd been abducted. He'd been aboard. I think they had been scanned or something. And then he'd seen these things swim back across the water and the thing taking off. And he talked about the big splash of something going underwater. So anyway, then he went on a ventilator and he couldn't talk. And unfortunately he died. And she never has remembered being on board, but she remembered the object and the real bright light on the inside. And she thinks she has surpassed memories. And that they reported as happening on the same night as the Pascagoula abduction. And they had their kids to verify that. That they had talked about it earlier, but, you know, didn't report it until then. And it was the daughter that reported it. So I put that in, and I'd written to her quite a bit and had the information, had the her direct quotes and writing and everything in. So there might have been a, there appeared to be several witnesses, and there might have been something unusual, very unusual, which was maybe a second abduction, maybe at the same time, and maybe even by the same object. So that was very, very unusual if it happened, and there's no way to check any of it.
So this man's kind of deathbed confession is, yes, we were abducted. He's held the secret all these years.
Well, so did Calvin. He didn't talk about it for about 50 years either. And yeah, the man didn't talk about it because in his position, you know, as a working person, he wouldn't want to be harassed. And I think that's true of a lot of people. If they have a job and they're a respectable person, they don't go around talking about UFOs. And that inhibits a lot of people from talking. So you don't get good information either way. I mean, it'd have been a lot better if they could have turned it in right then, but most people didn't. And that's something, it'd be better if the government had a way to, or some, you know, open-minded, objective.
Well, it does seem like they're getting better at that now. There's certainly more in the news about it. They seem to be talking more about what's going on. So I think that we are starting to see a shift in the way that this is being done. And obviously, all the years that we were told that the investigations into UFOs were over, we now know that it never ended. So there is something, you know, to that aspect of the case. And that, you know, I would love to see what their intelligence is regarding the Pascagoula event, even though they claimed we're no longer investigating UFOs. Did they ever get, either one of these two gentlemen ever get visited by Men in Black, by government, anybody to try to debrief and understand what they experienced to make sure that, you know, I mean, this was still Cold War time, you know, that it wasn't the Russians or the Chinese or somebody that might have infiltrated.
Well, this is another part of my book, is I talked about that Pascagoula made the news twice in a month's time, because there was another UFO report at that time. And this was an USO, an underwater submerged object that was reported and taken seriously.
Talk to us a little bit about that. And again, the book goes much more in depth into these cases, the stories, the eyewitness accounts, folks, but to give you a taste of some of the different aspects of this book and why it's important to look at and read, especially if you're into the ufology aspect of understanding these stories and the times and what was going on. So what was this USO encounter like?
That took place several weeks later. It was in water in the Pascagoula River, and it had 16 witnesses of this object that was underwater. 15 are dead, and I interviewed the very last person that's alive about it. What they saw was that they were fishing with nets, and this man, and I actually talked to the son. He was about 16 when it happened. He was with his father, and they saw this thing underwater. It was lit up in an object, and he described it as looking like the top of a parachute looking down on it. But it seemed to have whatever you call them, radius things sticking out from the center and things. It was underwater, and he thought the light that came from it was underneath it. Well, they couldn't figure out what it was, and his father was trying to hit it with an oar. He had a real long oar. And he hit it, and it sounded like metal. And they had no idea what it was. And some other people came, their relatives, and then some more, another family of fishers. And nobody could figure out what it was. So he and his father went to get the Coast Guard. And two Coast Guard officers came out in a larger boat by themselves, and they saw it too. And the thing would, it'd be lit up, and you could see it and everything. And then if they bothered it, like trying to hit it or things, it would disappear, and then it'd appear someplace else farther away, and they could go and find it, and it'd light up again. The Coast Guard officer thought it was very, very strange, because he said if you put an oar over it, that the light seemed to go right through the oar, just like an X-ray, and there wasn't a shadow. And so there were reports from them, two Coast Guard officers plus these people. It never showed up again after that one night. And they like wanted to try to catch it in their net or something, but they couldn't. Nobody had any idea what it was. Well, they were made fun of too. But the Navy took them very seriously and sent out some big shots to interview them. And just did a serious investigation, and one reason was because of the area, because it was close to a nuclear site. The Navy didn't want anybody to know that it was a nuclear site, and because of the ship building area, and because of a lot of other things that were going on at that time.
All right, very strange. So you've got multiple encounters, multiple style stories that are all taking place in this one area. Now, again, you said there's a nuclear base, there's a military installation. Why do you think that we see so much UFO activity over locations that would seem detrimental to them visiting, right? You would think that they wouldn't be so close to a place that could scramble jets or bombs in their direction. Or is that the concept? We're so close, there's no way they're going to attack here because it would rain down problems on their base, on their things. What do you think is the thought behind all of that? And how many of these UFO sightings take place around installations like this?
A lot do. And at that time, there was a lot going on, such as Watergate and Spiro Agnew and the oil crisis, Nixon and everything else you can think of. But what people didn't know too much about was there was the Yom Kippur War, and there was a nuclear alert that there might be an impending nuclear war. But they didn't report that until many, many, many years later, just fairly recently. But there was a possibility of a nuclear war starting around that time. I think the nuclear alert was on October the 24th or something, but it was classified for many, many years, so people didn't know about it. But there was a lot of other things, and some people that I knew about the interview said that it was a show of force from the UFOs, that like there was, you know, the possibility of a real big scale nuclear war starting, and that maybe the UFOs were sort of letting people know that there were other things here. And a number of people have also reported about UFOs flying over missile sites and turning off the targeting things or reprogramming targeting things on missiles. So you never know if something like that might have been going on, and maybe that had something to do with the sightings, because there were a lot of other sightings, and in a whole lot of them, there were interactions with authority, like airplane pilots and sheriffs and even governors and things like that in the UFOs, which was unusual.
The Pascagoula area, did UFO encounters stop after, you know, that period of time, or has it always been a hotbed now?
It didn't seem like it kept on going. And this was part of a big flap. It was a huge flap. It lasted, the main big part of it was in October, November, and then it went down all over the country and the world. There were just a huge number of sightings around that time.
Very strange. And were they similar? Have you found any other encounters anywhere around the world that seemed to match with what was taking place in Pascagoula during that time?
There were a couple of reports, like of there was this boy that said he was playing with a thing with wrinkled skin and pincher-like claws and things. But I just have the reports. I don't have any detail about them. I don't think there were too many like that, though.
Do you think some of these are stories that are playing off of, oh, yeah, I've seen those type of aliens as well, that, you know, people, again, just trying to inject themselves into this weird aspect of history?
Well, the people that I interviewed from Pascagoula, nobody else reported seeing anything like that. I mean, there were UFO reports, and some of them the same night from Pascagoula, and some of close objects, but nobody reported anything like that abduction and seeing beings, or whatever you'd call them, that were like that.
Dr. Scott, where do you think we are in the world with true disclosure? Do you believe that it is forthcoming, that there's going to have to be a forced hand into admitting this very soon? And do you think that we're on the precipice of true alien contact, not just a couple of one-off people here and there? It just seems that there's some kind of step up in the game right now with letting information out. You know, when secret military footage starts getting leaked, it to me seems like they're readying us for something.
It could be. in 1947, when UFOs started, there was Project Sign. It was a forerunner of Project Blue Book. And they took a very scientific look, said maybe this is ET or these things, you know, are unexplainable under our science and things. Then they debunked for years and years and closed Project Blue Book and said there was nothing going on, that we understood everything in the universe and, you know, we were the highest form of life in the universe and everything. Well, since then, the government this year reported that there might be things around that we can't explain. 60 Minutes has had it on, the New York Times and everything, and reports from Navy, like the Nimitz and the F-18 Hornets and tic-tac objects and all that, which actual pilots and things are going on TV and saying, yes, this happened. So it's a little bit harder for the government to say, oh, these people are crazy, because they're obviously not. And so there's a little more nudge for the government to report things. Then also, the Nimitz and everything was from the Navy. And the Air Force has always said since, in 1947, they said something might be happening. Then they've always debunked everything. Well, I think even back in 1973, when I looked at what the Navy was saying, they took it sort of seriously and did a serious investigation. Well, the information that's coming out now is mainly from the Navy, and they may be less, have less tendency to hide everything or debunk it or and all that than the Air Force has always had.
I hope you're right. I hope that we're at a position where at least some of the military are going to come forward. I know there was just an article that we read. I'm trying to see if I can even pull it up quickly here. And I found it really interesting that here you've got, you know, one of the leaders of all of our spy agencies admitting that, yeah, we think that this is most likely alien activity taking place. You know, that kind of removes a lot of the stigma. And when you've got one of the lead people, and I'm pulling it up here. Hold on 1 second. And it's been splashed all over MSN News and Yahoo News and New York Post. UFOs buzzing U.S. warships may be aliens, according to top spy chief. U.S. UFO buzzing warships and being reported by U.S. pilots could be alien origin, America's top spy chief has said in a stunning admission. Avril Haines, the director of National Intelligence, who oversees all 16 U.S. spy agencies, including the FBI and CIA, was speaking at the Our Future in Space event at the Washington National Cathedral. Haines was quizzed about UFOs, which have become a serious national security debate in the U.S. After years of being consigned to the dustbin of conspiracy theories. And she's come forward saying, yeah, this very well could be. They can't explain many of the cases that they've been up against. That's pretty damning, or not damning, but pretty fascinating when the director of national intelligence is kind of talking about this blasé, you know, just very, yeah, well, yeah, this is something we're looking into and something we need to keep an eye on.
Yes, I think it's opening up more. Back when UFOs started, they didn't know there were other solar systems or anything else. And since then, right, they found all kinds of planets and things. And people are saying, well, you know, if there's zillions of planets in the universe, why should we be the only ones with life and things?
Right.
And they've always sort of explained it back to the 1950s, like they did then, and with Newtonian physics. And now we have the quantum theory, and now we know that there's a lot more planets all over the place than anybody imagined. And so people are thinking it's more illogical to say, well, we're the only intelligent life in the universe like they used to.
Yeah, we're still questioning if we are the intelligent life in the universe, yeah, right?
Maybe a pretty low level.
That's right. Beyond Pascagoula, the rest of the amazing story. There is a link for the book on today's program guide. As we say our goodbyes, Dr. Scott, is there anything you'd like to leave our listeners with? Any new insights or thoughts, something to ponder about our place in the universe and what took place in Pascagoula?
Well, there's still an awful lot of that we don't know. And I'm finding out new things all the time. And the other thing, another part of the book that I spent a lot of time on, was at the same time as Pascagoula happened, there was a strange sound that was heard all across the United States, and there was no explanation for it at all. They're always saying, you know, UFOs don't have witnesses. Well, this would have had millions and millions of witnesses. And I spent a lot of time working on that, trying to figure out what it is, and I'm still working on it.
When did that take place?
The same time as the Pascagoula abduction.
Wow. And what was the sound? Can you tell us what was reported?
Well, it was a very, it was maybe the most extensive sound ever recorded except for the Krakatoa. It started in Iowa and it extended clear of the Atlantic coast. It was very wide and it couldn't be explained as an airplane sonic boom because it was way larger than an airplane sonic boom. And there were no evidence of airplanes up at that time in that area. And nobody paid too much attention to it except me. And I investigated it with some seismologists and some scientists before I ever got into UFOs. And trying to figure that out was what actually got me into UFO investigation. But it's never been explained to this day. And I'm still, I spent a lot of time in the book with NASA information on sonic booms and things and saying that this, in terms of physics, was way different than anything that could be explained as a sonic boom. And so I spent a lot of time on that with the book because it was just something that was unexplained and there was a lot of data on it.
Fascinating stuff. Pick up a copy of the book, Beyond Pascagoula, The Rest of the Amazing Story. Dr. Scott, great to catch up with you again. Thank you for being here with us.
Thank you for having me.
Stay safe, everyone. Be kind to one another. We'll be back again next week with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Darkness Radio.